Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Trillion-dollar deficits. That's the forecast for federal budgets starting as soon as next year, and those deficits could surpass $2 trillion annually within a decade. Those sobering statistics come from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Congress keeps sabotaging deficit and debt reduction. At the same time, an aging population is putting greater demand on Social Security and health care programs. Mark Goldwein is Senior Policy Director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, kind of like being both actuary and mortician for congressional spending. Mark, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Well, thank you for having me.
Before we dig into some of the numbers, I wanted to ask you about your work on the Simpson-Bowles Commission, obviously named for the former Senator Alan Simpson and former Clinton Chief of Staff Erskine Bowles, who you probably know lives in Charlotte. So what was it like working with Erskine Bowles?
Right. So in 2010, I worked with both Erskine Bowles and Al Simpson on coming up with what ended up being a large deficit reduction plan that, if enacted, would have really solved these problems. And I have to say, working for both Erskine and Al was just the opportunity of a lifetime. They really put country above party in a way that I hadn't seen before. Al Simpson, a longtime Republican, agreed to tax increases. Erskine Bowles, you know, a well-known Democrat, agreed to significant spending cuts, really made a lot of tough choices and was a lot of tough medicine, but would have saved the country a lot of the problems we're having right now.
And one of the things that they recommended was essentially $4 trillion worth of deficit reduction, correct?
That's right. Through a mixture of new revenue, spending cuts, healthcare cost reductions, reforms to Social Security, and other changes throughout government.
Why do you think so much of that report went unheeded, ultimately?
Well, because they were recommending things that were unpopular. It turns out, if you look at all the political science literature, or you just ask any politician, telling people they're going to pay higher taxes, or they're going to get fewer government services, or they're going to get a lower benefit, is not a popular position. What people want is they want low taxes, high spending, and they also want low debt. The problem is you cannot have all three of those things. And this was some tough choices.
And so not a lot happened with the information and the recommendations they made.
Well, former President Obama and former Speaker Boehner did try to negotiate two major grand bargain deals that were really based off of the framework of Simpson-Bowles. They mostly failed. They did succeed in recommending a piece of Simpson-Bowles, which was the cuts to what we call discretionary spending, the cuts to defense and non-defense appropriations. And those cuts stuck for a few years. But earlier this year, Congress not only reversed those cuts, but they actually increased defense and non-defense spending higher than what it would have been even absent these cuts. And so even that success only lasted for a few years. And I think that's part because it wasn't packaged with the other components.
Obviously, you've spent months and years not only digging through the numbers, but watching what Congress and administrations do, how they approach this. Republicans in particular made deficit and debt reduction a key tenet of their philosophy. They campaigned on it. We certainly have heard plenty of warnings about what would happen if deficits and the debt continued to spiral. How is it that we're in and I'm not trying to be partisan here, but just we have a Republican-led Congress, we have a Republican president, and we're now looking at trillion-dollar deficit next year. What's changing with that philosophy?
I think it's really easy to be a deficit hawk when you're out of power and you can just criticize the other party. It's a lot harder when you're in power. And it shouldn't be too surprising that Republicans cut taxes, even though that added to the deficit, because Republicans always sort of had two fiscal philosophies. The one was lower deficits, the other was lower taxes, and those were in conflict. What's really shocking is that many of those same Republicans then turned around and also increased spending. Remember, one of the arguments for tax cuts, it's supposed to starve the beast. Instead, it turns out it fed the beast. So we really have seen an abandonment of these fiscal principles. And by the way, as an additional element to that, the president ran on not touching Social Security, which would be really unusual for a Republican.
And so you have an economy that is in many ways roaring. And some of the concern out there is, well, when the inevitable recession or downturn arrives, then what happens with the deficits and the debt. So tell us a little bit about the tough medicine that could be on the way.
Look, any other time that we've had very high deficits, for example, the last time we trillion-dollar deficits, it's because we were in a recession and we were not getting tax revenue because, you know, people out of work don't pay much taxes. We were paying more in unemployment benefits and we were enacting stimulus. This will be the first time in history we've had trillion-dollar deficits when we're not in a recession and we're not in a war. In fact, the economy's booming. So if we're running trillion-dollar deficits when the economy's booming, imagine how high they will get the next time we do face a recession. And something I worry about and something that my much more liberal friends also worry about is when that time does happen, we won't have the fiscal space, either politically or economically, to pass stimulus or to pass the necessary measures to rescue the economy because the base debt, the base deficits will just be too high already.
You've heard this again many, many times, which is there are factions who now say that deficits are not problematic. You're already smiling as I'm bringing this up. and it's interesting because you have people on both sides of the ideological divide. I'm thinking of Paul Krugman, obviously the Nobel-winning economist. He had a column recently where he said, it was this month, he said that debt is, quote, absolutely trivial compared with, say, crumbling infrastructure, which should be fixed without worrying about paying as you go. In 2002, Vice President Dick Cheney, who is about as much of a polar opposite to Paul Krugman as can be imagined, said, quote, Reagan proved that deficits don't matter. So are those pervasive views in Washington now? And then secondly, do you think that is the case, that all of a sudden deficits don't matter?
So we used to call these folks debt deniers. You know, they're kind of akin to the climate deniers that no matter how much evidence you're faced with, continue to keep your head in the sand. And 2011, Erskine Bowles and Al Simpson declared the era of deficit denial is over. Turns out the era is back, and it's on both sides. On the right, many folks are saying, well, if it's for tax cuts or if it's for defense, the deficits really don't matter. If it's on the left, it's this new idea that they call it MMT, modern money theory, that we can borrow just as much as we want with barely any consequence at all. These are both ridiculous. And while I agree with Paul Krugman that we do have to address our infrastructure, every analysis I've seen, every serious analysis shows that if we borrow to pay for infrastructure, we're going to get basically no net growth out of it because we'll have more public investment. But when you borrow, you get less private investment and they will roughly cancel. So these folks are wrong, but it is pervasive. And it's driven by the fact that we've enjoyed pretty low interest rates over the last few years, despite high deficits.
So where do you think this is going, though? Because now you have, as you mentioned, the Republicans have been in power. They have increased spending as they've cut taxes. It's hard to believe that if the Democrats take over the House and or the Senate, that they won't consider increased spending. At what point? It's one of those things where I think all of our lives we've heard this can't go on, this can't go on, but it keeps going on. So do you see a breaking point?
One great thing about the United States, but which may also be on our undoing, is that we have such a strong, vibrant economy. We are the world's reserve currency. We borrow on our own currency. We are the global safe haven. Our treasury debt is the linchpin of the financial system. And so we can probably borrow a lot before we face some kind of crisis. But this is maybe the bigger they are, the harder they fall scenario. Yes, we could borrow more than a typical country before there's any kind of crisis. But if we do have a crisis, it would be a global financial crisis, global, because the U.S. Treasury is the linchpin of the entire financial system. Now, I hope it doesn't come to that. I hope it doesn't take a crisis for us to act. Although there's another equally tragic option, which is that we never have a crisis. We just see a permanent erosion of our growth potential. And 30 or 40 or 50 years from now, the economy is only half or two-thirds the size it could be, and we don't even know why. You know, it's a termite situation. We never even realize it until it's too late. I think those are both scary scenarios. The best case scenario is, I hate to say this, trillion-dollar deficits come back next year because that sounds bad. But the best case scenario is that's then a wake-up call. And policymakers on both sides of the aisle realize, whoa, we made some mistakes and we need to start fixing this. And we don't have to do it all at once, but we need to start getting our healthcare costs under control. We need to make Social Security solvent. We need to fix this tax code. And we cannot just keep borrowing year after year because we're really dooming our children and grandchildren to a worse standard of living.
So as you look around Congress, the administration, the broader political power in this country. Who's listening? Who's heeding the message in terms of seeing that day of reckoning and wanting to do something about it?
Right now, not very many folks in Congress care about this. I should say not many care enough to vote the right way. If you look at the tax bill, which, you know, it's going to add about $250 billion to the deficit just next year, and the spending bill, which will add $150 to $200, almost every member of Congress either voted for one of those two pieces of legislation or opposed them because they wanted them to be bigger. There were very few folks that really voted against both on fiscal grounds. But when trillion-dollar deficits return, as interest rates rise, I think focus on this will renew, and people are going to realize that they do have to get a grip on the current fiscal situation.
We are speaking with Mark Goldwine. He is a senior policy director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. When we come back, we're going to dig into a little bit about the funding challenges for children, among other topics. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg. I'm in for Mike Collins, and my guest today in studio is Mark Goldwine. He's the Senior Policy Director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget in Washington, and he has what seems like one of the most frustrating jobs in the world. So tell me a little bit about that aspect of it, which is you are presenting this information, you're nonpartisan, but you're clearly delineating what some of the challenges and problems are, and a lot of times the people in power aren't listening. So how do you stay optimistic, or do you stay optimistic in the face of that?
Sadly, I don't, not always. The big challenge of my job used to be that we knew changes had to be made to secure Social Security for future generations, changes to be made to make Medicare more sustainable, changes had to be made to make sure we're getting enough tax revenue. And the politicians didn't want to make the hard choices. Now the challenge is politicians actually want to do the opposite. They want to cut taxes, and they want to increase spending when the economic and fiscal situation call for the opposite. And it's extremely frustrating, especially from many of those same politicians that have been talking about how dangerous these levels of debt are. So every day is a challenge. And, you know, when your biggest sign of optimism is, don't worry, next year there will be trillion-dollar deficits, it's not a good sign. But I do think attention is going to refocus on this issue. And you know, my boss, Leon Panetta, always says, we govern by crisis or we govern by leadership. And I still hold out faith that leadership is an option, that our policymakers can come together and start to develop some real solutions.
So now, as a child, did you find federal budgets objects of fascination, or how did you get into this?
Let me tell you this. I was born on December 31st at 11:55 p.m. My mother was told she could have be in the newspaper as the first baby of the new year or get the tax break for the entire prior year. And they went for the tax break. So I was born out of fiscal policy, but this is an area that I really have been interested in since college, even a little bit since high school. And I've been working on this professionally for about a dozen years. And every year I work on it, the situation, frankly, has been getting worse, not better, as more and more time has passed and policymakers have refused to be thinking about future generations.
So obviously, all the things that we're talking about involve a lot of math, and people's brains sometimes just turn off when they hear numbers and math and trends and percentages. So when you're speaking to Congress, perhaps, but when you're just speaking to a general group, what kinds of basic principles do you try to leave people with to show them not only the context, but why this matters, why this is not just, oh, the federal deficit's still bad?
Well, one thing I like to do is take a step back and focus on some individual programs that matter to people. For example, Social Security. Social Security is funded with a payroll tax and through a trust fund. According to its own trustees, that trust fund is going to run out of money in 17 years. That is when today's 50-year-olds are reaching the normal retirement age. It's when today's youngest retirees aren't even 80. So people on the program today will still be on the program when it goes insolvent. And when it does, everybody, regardless of if you're 62 or 92, if you make $20,000 a year, $200,000 a year, everybody will get an across-the-board 20 to 25% cut. That's not only not prudent, it would be a retirement security disaster.
So let's stick with that one because that does resonate with everyone, I think. What are the possible solutions right now for Social Security, realistically?
Yeah. So sadly, we've waited too long for the easiest solutions. It used to be that we could say, we're just going to have everybody's benefits grow a little bit slower, or we're just going to have everybody's taxes rise a little bit faster, and that would solve it. We now need sort of a little bit of everything approach, or actually a lot of everything, but we do have time to phase in somewhat gradually. So for example, people only pay taxes on their first $130,000 of income. We could increase that cap, increase the amount that people pay taxes on. As another example, people are going to, the retirement age is going to go to 67, and it's going to stay there, even though people will continue to live longer. We could just index that retirement age. As a third example, the richest beneficiaries who retire 30 years from now may end up with $2 million of lifetime benefits. Social Security shouldn't be paying anyone $2 million, in my opinion. And so we can change the benefit formula gradually so people have time to plan and adjust so that higher earners receive a little bit less relative to what they're receiving today. And if we did those three things in some combination, we'd solve about two-thirds of the problem.
And again, the political appetite obviously has not been there so far. But when you talk about 17 years, I mean, that's not, you know, that's not 50 years. That's not a long time. Is it sinking in with anyone in Congress, or is it much more, I've got to win the next election, I can't worry about 17 years from now?
It's starting to sink in. You know, people have been talking about this. We've known about this problem since at least the early 1990s. We've been talking about solutions since at least the mid-1990s, and that's frankly when we should have enacted them. But it was always, it's far off, it's far off, it's far off. Now it's not far off. Now, again, current retirees will be affected. People in Congress are starting to notice, but you know who's really noticing? When I come here to Charlotte and I talk to regular folks that are just working regular jobs and would like to have a secure retirement for themselves and their children, around the country, people get it. When you tell them, when they have 17 years, they don't say, well, some future politician should worry about it. They say, let's get on this because we need to fix this. And if I'm going to have to work a little bit longer, I want to know now. If I'm going to have to save a little bit more, I want to know now.
You also obviously follow, and you mentioned a couple times, healthcare, and I want to get to that. But before we do, I want to ask you about an issue that your group has dedicated some time to, which is this idea of children not being funded to a high level in the federal budget. And the comparison, of course, is to programs for the elderly, which tend to be locked in, which tend to have automatic accelerators. And many of the children's programs, as you pointed out, don't. So let's just start with the basics. Can you take us through where those two paths diverge in terms of taking care of elderly versus children?
Sure. So the federal budget sort of gives a 1-2 punch to children. On the one hand, they're going to be burdened with all of our future debt. On the other hand, we're underinvesting in them relative to the elderly. About 10% of the budget, or 10% of spending and tax breaks, goes to children, despite the fact they're a quarter of the population. By comparison, nearly half of the budget, a third to half, depending on how you measure, goes to seniors. So seniors get a much larger take, despite the fact they're about a similar size of population. Now, some of that makes sense because senior healthcare costs are a lot higher than healthcare costs for children. But a lot of it, as we wrote in a paper that you can see on our website, crfb.org, is because the budget process is specifically stacked in favor of adults and seniors and against children. How is that true? First of all, most children's spending is temporary. Most children's spending is capped in a dollar amount. Most children's spending lacks built-in growth, or that built-in growth is about the rate of inflation, something like that. And barely any children's program has a dedicated revenue source. By comparison, most spending for seniors is permanent. Most of it is uncapped. It's unlimited. Much of it has dedicated revenue. And it has rapid built-in growth, almost always faster than wage growth, faster than the economy. Think about within healthcare. For seniors, there's Medicare. That's a permanent program that spends as much as seniors need. For children, there's CHIP. That is a temporary program. It constantly needs to be renewed every 5 or 10 years, depending on how much we extend it. It is capped. It is a finite dollar amount, and it doesn't have built-in growth. Similarly, think about TANF, which is temporary aid for needy families, which really is for children and their parents, compared to Social Security. Social Security is permanent. It's unlimited.
Well, for 17 years, it's permanent.
Right. Well, it's still permanent. Oh, it just gets a 22% cut.
Yeah, right.
But even then, but it's a fair point. And it grows every year with wage growth. TANF has literally zero built-in growth. So every year, if there's more beneficiaries, everyone gets a cut. And it needs to be renewed regularly. So the political process is biased against children. And that's reflected in the outputs. It's also reflected in the outcomes because the child poverty rate is about twice the poverty rate of seniors.
Yeah, I think it was 18% for children 18 and under and about 9.3% for those 65 plus. Tell me a little bit, you often say and write that, you know, making a budget is about making tough choices. So with that particular topic, what's the tough choice, or what tough choices would you make? Is it a direct you cut from Medicare or Social Security in order to help children? How do you weigh those two things when it comes down to the reality of getting the numbers to work?
Right. Part of the problem is the political framing of saying we're going to cut spending for the elderly to increase the children is not very good, especially when you consider that the elderly have an extremely high voting rate and children have roughly a 0% voting rate on account of they are not eligible. But we do need to start to rethink the defaults within these programs. As I said before, programs for the elderly sort of automatically grow faster than the economy. Programs for the children barely automatically grow before. If we just change that automatic default, it allows us to prioritize more on an annual, on an every 5-year and every 10-year basis, and decide where we're going to move scarce resources. And I'm not advocating that children get 50% of the budget and the elderly get 10%. But on the margins, maybe children shouldn't have a declining share of the budget or a rapidly declining share of the budget, and right now they do. I mean, the other important piece of this isn't just about child welfare. The best investment we can make in our economic future is strong children that become a strong workforce, strong in terms of their
skilled workers,
education, in terms of their nutrition, in terms of their physical, everything, exactly.
In terms of the disparity that we see right now, is it as simple as not only can children not vote, but also elderly voters tend to be some of the most dedicated voters? They show up at the polls when a lot of younger voters who are eligible don't. Is it that simple?
I think that's a piece of it, but I also think that politicians don't give their voters enough credit. I think that I go around the country and I talk to folks that are on Social Security that are over 65, and they would gladly pay a little more. They gladly would have taken a little bit less of a tax cut. And by the way, they got a disproportionate share of the tax cut for their children to have a more secure Social Security, to invest more in education. So I actually think grandparents want what's best for their children. But politicians aren't giving them enough credit. And they're just assuming that if they make any tough choices in the elderly, they'll get voted out.
I know, again, that you're nonpartisan, but in terms of assessing the tax cut that we talked about earlier, the Trump tax cut, there was immediate debate and disagreement about whether it was going to lift all boats as advertised or whether it was really helping the affluent and corporations and not helping the rest so much. Where do you come down on what it ultimately achieves?
Yeah, my evaluation, the first order effect is almost everyone got a tax cut, including relatively low to middle income, including high income. The tax cut at the top was a bit higher, mostly driven by the corporate tax cut, because most of that goes to owners of corporations, people that own stocks, which happen to be the wealthy. But the bigger distributional disparity wasn't between rich and poor. It was generational. The biggest tax cuts went to baby boomers and went to the elderly, especially the wealthier elderly. And the biggest tax increase is the one that's not embedded in the bill. It's the fact that it adds to the deficit, and so at some point we'll have to pay it back. And the baby boomers aren't going to be the one paying it back. If we enact a tax increase, say, 10 years in the future to offset this tax cut now, it's going to be mostly borne by folks that are today 30 and below, to some degree 40 and below. If we wait 20 years, it's going to be 20 and below. So yes, I think this, to some degree, tax cuts went a little bit more to the rich. But the bigger distributional issue is generational.
And so why do you think, I know you're focusing on deficits, you're not a political scientist, but you're in Washington, you're surrounded by this stuff. So I'm wondering, why do you think deficit reduction, debt reduction have sort of faded as campaign issues? I mean, there was a time when however well or poorly Congress was doing with the actual issue, it was very much in the public debate. Now it feels like it's been sort of shoved to the side. Why do you think that's happened?
So I think there's a few issues. First of all, what really brought attention to this issue last time was when we had trillion-dollar deficits during the Great Recession. Now, those were not dangerous deficits. In fact, they were necessary deficits given the recession. But they brought attention to a broader issue. As those deficits came down, attention faded. On top of that, I think there's some degree of deficit reduction fatigue. There were so many months and years of negotiation, mostly failed negotiation, that I think folks got tired of it and immune to it. And lastly, some of our biggest fears of what would happen with high deficits didn't come to be. Interest rates remained low for a while. They are starting to rise now. There was not any kind of fiscal crisis here like there was in some of the other countries around the world. And so I think for that reason, the public has lost focus and lost attention, as have politicians who really would prefer to be talking about giving stuff away, giving away tax cuts, giving away new spending, you know, Medicare for all, expanded Social Security, lower taxes, more defense. These are the fun promises politicians make. You're going to pay more in taxes, get a lower mortgage deduction, work longer, and pay more for your Medicare. It's not a great campaign slogan. But with trillion-dollar deficits coming back and interest rates rising, I do think this issue is going to come back.
So it sounds like in some ways it's as simple as these are the most challenging, difficult aspects of governing, and you know we can put that off till the night before the exam and focus on other things?
I think that's exactly right. Politicians are thinking about the next election, not the next generation.
Well, we're going to try and think a little bit more about the next generation when we come back with Mark Goldwine from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest today in studio is Mark Goldwine. He's the Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, and he has plenty to tend to at the moment. So we were talking a little bit about Social Security in the previous segment. I want to ask you about the other obvious, huge, looming challenge out there, which is healthcare. Most of us sort of start spinning immediately when healthcare costs are brought up, just trying to figure out how you would even get a handle on this. So what needs to happen with healthcare to make it manageable?
Some context. The United States spends more on healthcare than any other country in the world, about twice as much as the average among among similar countries, among other developed nations. And about half of that is from the federal government. About half of that, I should say, is from federal and state governments. It's also rising unsustainably, and it's not only breaking the federal budget, it's a problem for state and local budgets, it's a problem for businesses, it's a problem for individuals. And so we need to get our healthcare costs under control. There's no one solution, but the key thing we can do to get lower costs without reducing quality is to change the incentives within the system. And two incentives in particular I'll focus on. The first is that Medicare especially, but much insurance, is what's called fee-for-service, which basically means the more that a doctor does, the more tests that he or she runs, the more procedures that he or she gives you, the more he or she gets paid. We need to move away from that and toward a system where a doctor gets paid, a hospital gets paid based on your incident, or even based on your outcomes. That would be ideal, based on the quality of care. That's not going to happen all at once, but we are moving in that direction. So that's on the provider side. On the individual side, we also need to make sure that consumers are able to shop effectively for healthcare. And that means I think Medicare should do more what's been done in the private sector, which is more high deductible, medium deductible plans where folks have some skin in the game. It also means that cost sharing needs to better reflect different prices. For example, if there's one pill that costs the insurance company $10, another pill that costs the insurance $100, and they do roughly the same thing, users should be driven toward the $10 pill. Mm-hmm. They're not right now, generally not. So if we improve the incentives for beneficiaries and improve the incentives for providers, we can make significant progress in getting healthcare costs down.
And again, I mean, in a way, the question almost answers itself. Do you see the willingness in Congress? But maybe a better question would be, what will be the tipping point to get members of Congress to seriously discuss changes?
So in some ways, I see more of an opportunity in healthcare than in some of the other deficit reduction because we have the opportunity to have win-wins. We have the opportunity to give people basically the same level of care, similar level of care, similar outcomes in a way that costs beneficiaries less money and costs the government less money. It's hard to do that in Social Security or in taxes or anything like that. So there's potential for win-wins. What we need to do is turn our focus to cost control. And I think the Medicare for All debates are a distraction from that. I think the repeal and replace debates are a distraction from that. But the truth is, the vast majority of Americans are much more concerned about health care costs than anything else. And there's an opportunity here. And to the president's credit, he's starting to jump on this, particularly when it comes to prescription drug costs. And some of his ideas are good, some are bad, but that's not the point. The point is that he's getting the country to start to focus on this. And this is an area where Democrats and Republicans should agree. We all want lower drug costs, so long as it's not, you know, compromising our ability to have access to safe and life-saving drugs.
You mentioned the president. We've talked a little bit about his tax cuts. You mentioned some of his thoughts on health care. You cannot come through any interview right now without having a question about Bob Woodward's new book. So here I'm going to give you your question about fear, which is this. I don't know if you've seen this yet or not, but it includes an account of President Trump telling his then National Economic Council director, Gary Cohn, quote, just run the presses, print money, end quote, as a way of reducing federal debt. Cohn reportedly replied, you don't get to do it that way. Now, I should preface this with both the president and Gary Cohn dispute this account. But assuming that there is veracity to it, what do you make of that exchange?
What's funny is how sometimes ideas on the left, ideas on the far left and ideas on, in some ways, the far right come together to the exact same idea, right? Which is we can just print our money to solve our way out of this. Now, I agree. The United States borrows in its own currency. So if we don't care about an independent Federal Reserve, runaway inflation, slow economic growth, no investment, or eventual fiscal crisis, then sure, we can print money. But I'm worried about all of those things. And if we just print money indiscriminately, we're going to have those. In fact, just brief history, every single country I'm aware of that has tried to print their way out of fiscal crisis has, at minimum, had a monetary collapse, if not a full societal collapse. I mean, the fall of the Roman Empire was because they tried to debase their currency. They basically, you know, threw their coins in the melter and based them down to try to print money. The Weimar Republic, right, that was the Germany before World War II, they tried to print their way out of their debts. Argentina, Zimbabwe, every time a country's tried to print their way out of the debts, it's led to total disaster. And so no, you don't get to do that.
I think you're with Gary Cohn on that one. Again, we're speaking with Mark Goldwine, who's a senior vice president and senior policy director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. I want to ask you about something that I think you did perhaps last year. It was a rundown of 20 or so ways that Congress sort of fudges the numbers, obscures the impact of various laws and financial policies. Take us through some of those, because, you know, these budget bills are, you know, to the moon, and very few Americans have the time or, frankly, the desire to read through some of what's going on when it comes to fiscal policy. So what do you see when you dig into those?
So my colleague Zach Mueller wrote what I call the Bible on budget gimmicks. Now, what I'm worried about is politicians will use this to actually enact those gimmicks. But this is meant to be as a warning. It's all the cheats and sleights of hands that Congress uses to make it look like they're reducing deficits when actually they're increasing them. I can't go through all of them, but let's talk about the minibus appropriations bill, because there's a few in there. One is something called chimps. You know, they're monkeying around with chimps. And basically what they do here is a chimp is a change in mandatory program, which basically means they're allowed to cut spending on the mandatory side of the budget, the entitlements, in order to increase spending discretionary. There's nothing wrong with that per se, except for what they do is they cut fake spending on the mandatory side. They cut spending that's either never going to be spent, or they cut it by delaying it 1 year. And then they use that, and they only look at the first year, so they don't see the increase in year two. And then they use that fake cut to pay for real increases in discretionary spending. So this minibus, which includes health funding, actually cuts money in children's health insurance program, money that will never, ever be spent. And it uses that money to pay for real increases in health spending. And real increases.
So these are phantom savings.
Phantom savings to pay for real costs in a bill that already benefits from a $150 billion increase in the caps to start with. So this is kind of ridiculous. They also declare some actual base defense spending as war spending, as basically emergency war spending. We call this OCO, Overseas Contingency Operations, in order to basically exempt it from the existing budget cap. So just this one minibus between chimps and OCO, chimps and war spending, spends $10 or $15 billion more than what it's pretending to.
Wow. And you, I mean, I think you've been around this long enough to know most people would guess that you're never going to kill all of this, obviously. But the idea is maybe to put some sunlight on it and at least reduce it or get rid of some of those things.
There is a commission meeting right now, a special joint committee of Congress, that's goal is to do appropriations and budget process reform. One thing they could do is change some of the rules to make it harder to do some of these gimmicks. They can change the way they're scored. They can have what's called a point of order in the Senate, which allows the senator to object to some of these gimmicks and then it goes away. They can increase transparency on them. Can never, whatever rules you make, somebody will be smart enough to find a way to cheat it. But we're not even trying to close these loopholes, and we should be.
And in a similar way, on the legislative side, you have, for example, with the tax cuts, the individual income tax cuts expire, I think, after 8 years, right?
That's right.
And so there's already a move afoot to make those permanent. And whether that happens in the near future or not, isn't the tendency that these things do eventually become permanent?
Yeah, so one of the gimmicks, the tax bill was supposed to originally be revenue neutral, but then they finally drew the line at it's only, I'm putting air quotes, only going to add $1.5 trillion to the debt, which is a lot of money. But it turns out they couldn't even do that. So what they did is instead of having it permanent, where it's scored over 10 years, they shrunk it down to 8 years, right? And so they could basically have a $2 plus trillion tax bill look like it's only costing $1.5 trillion, knowing that there's a high likelihood they're just going to extend it. This is one of those gimmicks that we just need to stop. It's not helping anyone. It's just frankly lying to the American public.
Not to depress you and the listeners further, but you know, for those of us who either follow these things or old enough to remember, the first president, George Bush, H.W. Bush, famously made the promise, no new taxes. Then he did raise taxes and he paid the ultimate price. So with examples like that out there, what's going to give politicians courage?
The fear that cost of doing nothing is the worst thing of all. That's what it's going to take. I mean, I think there's two ways this can go down absent a crisis. One is that they see the benefit to saying we save Social Security, but the other is that they see a cost to being punished for going to allow these debts to be on a runaway basis. And the public is going to start getting angry. I mean, I'm already seeing it boil over. When I mentioned that trillion-dollar deficits are happening next year, not during a recession, but during a boom, not during relative peace time, people are angry. And as they get angrier, hopefully that motivates some of our policymakers in both parties to do the right thing.
Yeah, I'm curious. It sounds like you travel around the country and give a fair number of speeches about what's going on with the nation's financial picture. What do you hear from people? I'm sure there's plenty of frustration, but what specific issues seem to resonate again and again?
People are scared Social Security is not going to be that for them there at all, which actually is a big opportunity because even under current law, 3/4 of it is going to be there. So it means that we can make a Social Security plan that both gives them more than they think they're going to get and saves money relative to where we're going. People are worried that they're not, I mean, there's a distribution. They're worried that they're not benefiting from the tax cuts and from the spending increases. And they're worried about what they're leaving to their kids and their grandkids. I mean, everybody knows you cannot infinitely borrow infinitely more money. You can't do it in a business. You can't do it at the state level. You can't do it at a household level. And you can't do it at the federal level. And people are worried about what's going to happen when it's time to pay those bills back.
I want to ask you, and I mentioned the Paul Krugman column from earlier this month, and you mentioned that healthcare might be an area where both sides could have some wins. I am continually baffled and confounded by the issue of infrastructure, because that one to me seems not only so much needed, but it seems like one that can forge bipartisan consensus, and yet not a whole lot is happening in that area. So as someone who watches the federal budget being put together, why is that not why is there not a deal there to be made?
Well, assuming Democrats take the House, you could see sort of a bipartisan opportunity on infrastructure. The president wants it, Democrats want it. Something I'm concerned about is a couple things I'm concerned about is that what they'll agree to is deficit finance it. And infrastructure is good because it creates new public investment, but deficits reduce private investment. And everyone that's looked at this, from the Congressional Budget Office to the folks at Penn Wharton, basically has concluded that if you deficit finance infrastructure, you'll have roughly zero net effect in the economy. You'll wash itself out. And so what we need is something like a gas tax or a vehicle miles travels tax or an oil tax or some other source of funding. And the president's open to these things, as are some congressional Republicans, but it's going to require leveling with the American people. And there are interest groups out there that are fighting hard against these ideas. Even a few cents, you know, a penny a month for 2 years would buy us all the infrastructure we need and fully fund our highway trust fund. And you wouldn't notice it because that's smaller than the volatility in gas prices. But the political firestorm would be significant.
Mark Goldwine, again, is a senior vice president and senior policy director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Go out there and solve the deficit and the debt. Thanks so much for listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.